rarely does a week go by on this show that we don't talk about some manifestation of religion's encroaching on our secular society. As I take pains to explain on a regular basis, this doesn't come from a hatred of religion, but rather from a profound respect for religion, something that is as important to countless Americans as their faith must not be corrupted and contaminated in the service of political or even cultural goals. And, just as importantly, the essential rights of Americans to worship or not worship as their consciences dictate must be protected. Now, if you ever doubted the relevance, urgency, and importance of keeping on this week after week and year after year, your doubts will evaporate after reading a shocking new report from Political Research Associates titled "Redefining Religious Liberty: The Covert Campaign Against Civil Rights." In it, author J. Michelson lays bare the well-organized, well-funded, and alarmingly effective campaign to fundamentally redefine the meaning of religious liberty. Michelson presents case studies, facts, and figures, but just as important, he convincingly traces both the technique and the objective back through history and offers a future that would be unrecognizable to many of us who treasure the constitutional separation of church and state. Well, with that, I'm very pleased to welcome back to State of Belief Radio, J. Michelson. Welcome, Jay.
Pleasure to be here, Wilton.
Jay, this past week, you and I were at the same conference dealing with the subject of redefining religious liberty here in Washington, D.C. And because these kinds of events often are quiet on the one hand and cerebral on the other, I want you to start by telling us what happened. I mean, it was anything but quiet and just cerebral. What happened?
Well, you know, I think that's right. And one reason that happens is folks tailor their message to who they think is in the audience. And I think at that conference, there were some folks from a relatively conservative point of view who really kind of tried to play softball with their own positions and make them out to be much more reasonable than they actually are. And having just completed 6 months of research on this report that you mentioned, I just wasn't willing to let that happen. And so, you know, we were told that the biggest encroachments, the biggest issues around religious liberty are people who just want to speak their mind, you know, like the CEO of Chick-fil-A. But that's not true. You know, the folks who were at that conference from the Beckett Fund, they're representing another company called Hobby Lobby, which doesn't want to just speak its mind, but impose its view on all of its employees and deny them the right to have insurance coverage for their contraception. So, you know, I just wasn't willing to be spun in the way that the presenters wanted to spin it. And I think when they were confronted with some of their actual positions, the jig was up.
Yeah, truth. I mean, truth is a controversial thing. to be honest, it would be valuable to have you just read the entire paper here today, but time doesn't allow for that. So let me ask you just to summarize what you contend in this important report.
Well, I think, you know, a lot of folks, a lot of listeners, I'm sure, really value religious liberty as a central fundamental constitutional value. And as you said, that's true as much for people of faith as for anyone else. You know, the separation of church and state was meant to originally to protect the church, not the state, but to protect the church from the wilderness of the state. But that term has now become a code word, kind of like family values. Mm-hmm. And it's been turned from a shield into a sword. So religious liberty in the free exercise clause of the First Amendment is meant to be a shield. It's meant to protect your personal, individual free exercise of religion. And so many of us, I'm sure, you know, again, many listeners remember the Religious Freedom Restoration Act from a little while ago. I was actually working on the Hill for the person who drafted that law. That was meant, and it passed 97-0 in the Senate for a reason, because it was meant to protect minority religions and religious practitioners from having their religious practices restricted by the government. It's a shield. But now it's been used as a sword. now religious liberty is being used by a small group of very conservative Catholic intellectuals and conservative evangelical political figures to impose one's own view on others and discriminate against other people. So, for example, I should be able, as a bully on a high school schoolyard, to quote-unquote express my disapproval of homosexuality in the form of bullying a gay teenager. Mm-hmm. Or, in that case of Hobby Lobby, which I mentioned, I should be able, as the boss, to simply not cover any forms of health care, such as contraception, that I may deem to be objectionable. This is radically new. This is a change in how we understand religious liberty, and it's kind of playing the victim. It's a shift of who's really doing the discriminating, who's the victim, and who's the oppressor. Okay. I think most of us would say if there's a bully and a kid being bullied, that the kid being bullied is really the victim. But in this conservative religious liberty rhetoric, it's the bully who's the victim if they're not allowed to express their opinion. It's the wedding photographer who's the victim if she's not allowed to discriminate against gay couples or potentially against couples of a different faith or a different ethnic group. Mm-hmm. And that really is worrisome, because for many of us who have fought for religious liberty for decades, we're seeing the very term be co-opted right in front of our eyes.
Right. Well, you go way beyond what I'm afraid many of us get caught up in oftentimes, the immediate political and social implications of individual attempts to redefine religious freedom. And you discuss, rightly discuss, the historical origins of this strategy and how it came to be so prevalent today. I think it's very important you talk about that.
Well, and this is an important part of our history that I think a lot of folks don't know. You know, there's a myth that the so-called Christian right, that the political Christian right, came in response to Roe versus Wade and in response to the concern over abortion. But actually, as the historian Randall Balmer has written about in two books, the Christian right was born in response to a different case, the Bob Jones University case. And that was a conservative evangelical college that had a racist admissions policy, and then it was later a racist housing policy, kind of segregation, and later a racist dating policy that blacks and whites couldn't date one another. And the IRS took away Bob Jones University's tax exemption. Notice they didn't tell them to stop their policy. They didn't stop them from doing what they were doing, but they took away their tax exemption as a result of these extremely offensive and racist policies. Mm-hmm. And the university fought back, claiming religious liberty or religious freedom. This same argument that is now being used to fight against women's rights and to fight against gay rights was used to fight against civil rights in the 1970s and the early 1980s. And Bob Jones University is still, all this time later, 35 years later, still a rallying cry for folks on the evangelical right. They still believe that case, which was decided eventually by the Supreme Court in 1983, that was wrongly decided, that Bob Jones should have still been able to go along with their tax exemption, even though they were violating public policy with those policies. So, you know, it's an old argument that's been repurposed into a new space. And that's happened. I'll just one last point on that. You know, the reason that Bob Jones University fled religious freedom in the 70s was they had already lost the moral battle about desegregation. This was one of the last bastions of segregation and institutionalized racism in that form. And today, we're seeing a very similar thing happen with regard to LGBT rights and LGBT equality. All of the data shows us that reasonable Americans, whether they're conflicted Christians or moderates or whatever their religious beliefs are overwhelmingly now in favor of same-sex marriage and of equal rights for LGBT Americans. And having lost that moral battle on the merits, they're now fighting the same political battle with this new language of religious liberty. Just like they did with segregation, they're now doing again when it comes to LGBT equality.
Jay, that is such a thoughtful and insightful review of a whole lot of history. And I couldn't help but think, as you were talking, several years ago, I became friends with, or maybe just an acquaintance with, a young man who was working with some of the grandfathers of the religious right. And he told me he was in the room when a conversation went on between these early leaders. And they said intentionally, it is time for us to embrace a strategy of convincing American conservatives that they are victims and that they are living in a society in which they are persecuted against and which they're martyrs. Personally, it makes me sick at my stomach because it takes a word that has a great history, the word martyr, a word that has a great history and is filled with integrity for people who have stood up for the right things and been hurt by it, and for that to be used as a categorization of the people who are trying to take over this nation in the name of their particular religion makes me sick at my stomach.
It is absolutely sickening. You know, it was interesting at that conference that we were at just a few days ago. There were people there who were working for real religious liberty around the world. You know, numerically, just how many human beings are being persecuted for their religion. Christians are probably the most persecuted religion in the world, mm-hmm. but really real persecution. People are being put to death. Right. People are right. being discriminated against in countries around the world. And there are folks who are forging alliances with conservative Christian organizations and religious liberty advocates and really working on behalf of people who are really the victims of religious discrimination. And to see the same word, religious liberty, used here as a sword instead of a shield and as this rhetorical club to fight the culture war is incredibly disturbing because actually religious liberty is in danger in many countries in the world. And it's this very cynical misuse of the same term to defend people whose lives are at stake as to defend people here who simply want to discriminate against other people.
That's exactly right. Well, let me be specific with a question, and you be as specific as you want to be with the answer. Where do you most see this happening? What majorities in the United States do you see identifying themselves as victims and trying to actually prostitute religious freedom under that kind of disguise?
Well, this has been the rhetoric's been going on for a while, that there's a notion there's a war on religion. Phyllis Schlafly wrote a book on the so-called war of religion. Our friend Donald Wildman wrote a book also calling the Obama administration, you know, fighting a war on religion. But you know what's disturbing is that it's not just those extremists anymore. At the vice presidential debate in November, Paul Ryan accused the Obama administration of waging a war against Catholic churches, Catholic hospitals, and Catholic charities. Mm-hmm. This was not just a fringe moment. You know, this was really one of the high watermarks of this religious liberty movement, that a mainstream candidate for vice president parroted the rhetoric that has been defined by these activists in such a forum as a vice presidential debate. It was an incredibly disturbing moment. And, you know, I think to give another specific example of why this is so disturbing, it's one thing when you have someone kind of quoting the Bible in your face and shouting fundamentalist slogans. You kind of know where they stand. But religious liberty is a value we all share. It's a constitutional value. Stanford University recently accepted a multimillion-dollar grant from the Beckett Fund, which is an organization funded by conservative Catholic organizations, including the Knights of Columbus, to establish a Stanford Center for Religious Liberty on the campus of Stanford University. This is absolutely unprecedented, and it shows the degree to which this argument, this strategy, has succeeded in co-opting mainstream institutions. The vice presidential debate, Stanford University, you don't get much more mainstream than that. And you would never see, for example, Stanford University create a pro-life center to rescue the unborn or you know, some other traditional family values center. Mm-hmm. This strategy is working where other strategies have failed.
We have observed the coming together of evangelicals and the Catholic bishops around the issue of birth control in the HHS debate and mandate. But reading your report, it starts to seem possible that these two groups came together first around strategy, the strategy we're talking about, using religious liberty rhetoric, and only then around a particular issue. Do you think that's possible, or do you just know that's real?
Well, that's happened. That's a matter of history. You know, we do have to go a little further back into history, but it used to be evangelicals thought that, you know, the anti-Catholicism in the evangelical church was enormous.
Right.
You know, they were the bitter enemies, and all kinds of horrible things were said about, you know, about John F. Kennedy and about the Pope and about the Catholic Church. All of a sudden in the 1970s, there was an alliance that was formed. And if you really go back, there's a writer named Jonathan Dudley who's written really well about this, about the pro-life movement and the notion that life begins at conception. That was a point of Catholic dogma. And evangelicals never believed it. In fact, they explicitly repudiated it until the 1970s, when it became politically expedient to create this alliance between Catholic intellectuals and sort of evangelical so-called foot soldiers. And it started with, again, with religious liberty around Bob Jones University and around race and segregation. All of a sudden, the evangelical population, which had been against parochial schools, started creating their own schools and started asking for school vouchers and funding of religious institutions. And that goes right up until the present moment, where there's this cooperation. You know, one of the questions that a skeptic might ask about the report, they might say, well, I get it that these are conservative folks, but don't they really believe that their religious liberty is under attack? How do we know that it's really this coordinated campaign? And to be honest, they do believe. A lot of these folks really do believe that religious liberty is under attack, but you just have to follow the money. So at the religious liberty rallies that were held in last year, and both in the summer and in the fall, the organizations that turned out the numbers were pro-life organizations. These were not religious liberty organizations. These were the same folks who just want to fight abortion for the same reasons that they've always wanted to fight against abortion and reproductive rights. And they've just found a new strategy by which to do so. And that alliance that was forged in the pro-life movement is that same Catholic evangelical alliance that's been so devastatingly effective in getting religious exemptions to guarantees of a woman's right to choose.
You expose in your book an astonishing amount of material about budgets in the service of this very kind of work. And, Jay, I can tell you this is ironic. A lot of our listeners know this. I used to be a leader in the Southern Baptist Convention. It was in the Southern Baptist Convention that I learned religious liberty and the importance of religious freedom for Baptists. It was after the political takeover of the fundamentalists in the Southern Baptist Convention that they decided that they would continue to use religious freedom language, but they would use it in the cause, much as the Roman Catholic bishops do, in the cause of advancing their own religion, believing that religious freedom was for them, but not equally for others.
Oh, that's absolutely right. And, you know, I think what a lot of folks who are doing that, who are kind of cynically exploiting religious freedom, don't realize is kind of the law of unintended consequences. This is a slippery slope. So if you suppose I'm that CEO of Hobby Lobby and I don't want to provide contraception coverage to my female employees because they may one day use it to obtain contraception. Well, now suppose I'm a member of the Church of Christ Scientist and I have a religious objection to health care in general. Does that mean that I shouldn't have to provide any health care coverage to anyone? Mm-hmm. Or again, suppose I'm a Muslim and I want to use the same rationale to say that I shouldn't have to, you know, there's a case of a Muslim taxi driver who didn't want to take drunk passengers in his taxi and wanted to refuse them. Once we open Pandora's box and start saying that religious liberty is something that can be used as a sword against third parties, right, that can infringe on third parties' rights, folks are going to wake up and realize that, you know, they've let out a lot more than they expected when they opened that box.
Seems like we've gone from the free exercise of religion to a free exercise of commerce, all under the guise of religious liberty. You make some really insightful points about widely publicized cases like the wedding photographer who was sued for not shooting a same-gender wedding. So we're no longer talking about religious freedom as it impacts a person's freedom of conscience or freedom in a house of worship. We're now talking about a debate over the meaning of religious liberty in every area of our life. Right?
Absolutely. You know, there was an op-ed just a few weeks ago called The Conscience of a Corporation, and that title really says it well. You know, I almost wish if Mitt Romney's right and corporations are people, and now we're going to allow corporations to have religious consciences so that they don't have to obey the same laws that all the rest of us have to obey. You know, maybe we should take that seriously. Maybe we should force corporations to tithe their income, you know, or to live by the rule of the gospel. Or, you know, it's interesting, a very selective choosing of which religious tenets corporations suddenly have a religious conscience to obey. But, you know, I just go back to the idea that we render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and we render unto God what is God. That seems to me to be a pretty good and time-honored distinction, that when you're operating in the marketplace, you're opening a large business. And by the way, as a legal matter, small businesses, mom-and-pop shops, are almost always exempted from anti-discrimination law. This is only about bigger right. businesses. When you're opening a large business, a large corporation, you have to play by certain rules. This is America, and we have an agreement that discrimination is wrong. And even if you think that discrimination is right, by acting in the marketplace, you need to play by the same rules as everyone else.
Jay, I wish we had a lot more time because we could go on and on. I think it's important, since we've got to end our interview, tell our listeners how they can get more of this information, how they can see what you're writing, how they can find this report, so that the conversation and interest can go on and on off the air.
Absolutely. Folks, just visit the website politicalresearch.org. That's the Political Research Associates website. The report's right there on the front page. I think if folks want to learn more about this, the report at last count I'm looking here is 48 pages long. So there's a whole lot of data there. And you can just look at the case studies yourself and learn more about this issue so that you understand it personally. So Jay, it's politicalresearch.org.
Jay Michelson is the author of the new report, Redefining Religious Liberty, The Covert Campaign Against Civil Rights. It's just out from Political Research Associates. If you ever wondered how we came to this point regarding the concept of religious liberty, you're going to find some answers in these pages. Jay Michelson holds a Ph.D. in Jewish thought from Hebrew University and a J.D. from Yale Law School, and he's the author of God Versus Gay, The Religious Case for Equality. Jay, you've made an invaluable contribution to our understanding of a process that's come to define our public debate over everything from marriage equality to school bullying and science education, and I can't thank you enough for being with us today to talk about it. If we were looking for just one thing to justify the existence of this radio program, this report would be a fine candidate. It's tragic. But you're not likely to hear a discussion of this issue anywhere else in the media. But you can hear it here in State of Belief, and you can read the report at politicalresearch.org. And, Jay, I thank you again for the contributions that you've made to this show and to the lives of our listeners.
Well, thank you, Wilton. And what you just said is why this show is so important. So thank you for the work that you're doing as well.